Welcome to North Coast Church. Today, Pastor Chris Brown is bringing the teaching to you, so open up your Bibles and listen in.
Father, thanks for this time and kind of a new chapter for many of us. And God, as we come back to your word, well, that's exactly why we're here, because we really believe this is your word. And I just pray, God, that you would speak to us, that you would use not just a blind faith, not just hearts and emotions, but God, the mind, the intellect that you've given us to really search this. Truth is worth searching and can stand up to it. And so, God, may we be open to what we're about to hear. God, I pray that we come to this book not because we care what North Coast believes or what I have to say, but God, back to just believing this is truly your words, what was said, how you live, what was done. And I pray that today creation would speak to, Creator would speak to creation, that God would hear from you. And if there's something in our lives that just doesn't match up, give us the strength to be the ones that change instead of constantly wanting you to change to fit our program. And so we give you this time in Jesus' name. Amen. Over the last about week and a half, I had family come out and stay with us. My baby brother and his wife and his kids from Missouri came down. My parents came out from Texas where I grew up, and we're all hanging out at our house. And someone came by, gave us Legoland tickets. I guess Legoland's just a few people shy of meeting some goal for the year, and they were giving employees tickets, and someone thought about us. And we used to go to Legoland. About 2 years ago, we had family passes. We went a lot. Since then, we haven't been. And so I get Legoland tickets dropped off for, like, the entire family. And so we're waiting. But those of you here know that we had 4 days of rain just a while ago. And so I'm sitting on free Legoland tickets for rainy day, rainy day, rainy day, rainy day. And of course, my kids are getting up every morning and looking outside and just the outpouring, the flood. And they're like, Dad, it doesn't look too bad. Can we go? And I'm like, no, we ain't going to Legoland in this. This is a flat out blizzard for Southern California. And so we're not driving in this. And we wait. And then after that fourth day, sun comes out. Things are wet, but you got a sunny day. We decide that's the day we're going to Legoland. And we show up there along with the rest of Southern California. And on that day, Legoland has a record attendance, and the place is crazy packed. Well, my little kids are roller coaster kids. My girls just love roller coasters. From the time they can get their head up to that little bar that says you're this high, man, they've been going. And so we take the rest of the cousins, and we all get online for the little dragon roller coaster. It starts off inside a castle. You see Lego figures with swords and a big Lego dragon, and then it goes outside, and it spins around, And so we get the kids. Are you sure you want to go on this? And everyone's like, yeah. And we get in line. And because of just the way my mind works, I have to have something to watch and do. As soon as I get in line, I start my stopwatch. I'm timing every line. Not a big fan of lines. Never stood in line. Never followed a line most of my life. So this is going to be tough for me. But you make the most of it. You make the most of the games, the roller coaster going by. I tell the kids, hey, we're about halfway there. Hey, we're 5 turns away. Hey, we're only 3 turns away. Hey, we're almost inside the castle. That's where we get on the roller coaster. And I'm trying to keep them going. We get all the way inside where the attendant looks at us, and now she asks, how many do you have in your party? And I look down, I'm like, we're going to take your entire roller coaster. She tells us what car we're about to get into. I look at my watch, 49 minutes, 27 seconds. I have waited for this ride, and I'm finally there. And when she tells us we're getting in car number 3, my 5-year-old Bear looks up to me and he goes, Dad, I don't want to go. And with all the compassion of a father, I look at him and go, you're going on this roller coaster. I'm going to give you 49.27 reasons why you're going on this roller coaster. Dad, I don't want to go. And I'm like, it's just going. It's Lego. It's a castle. It's a fake dragon. It's not even that big. We're at Legoland, for Pete's sake. You're going on the roller coaster. And then the attendant looks at me, sir, are you going or not? And I have a decision to make. And I'm wondering, will she let me forcibly hold a child, pin him in the seat next to me? Is that against their rules? And the thought hits me, is this on video somewhere? I don't need that type of publicity. So I have to tell my son. And I've been down and I look at Bear and I'm all, Bear, look at me. You're going to ride with Dad. My arms are going to be around you the entire time. See that little girl that just got off? She's smiling. She's smaller than you. This isn't something to be scared of. Your sisters love this ride. It's one of their favorites. I promise you, sit with me. Nothing will go wrong. And that little guy looks into the eyes of his father. And because of my words and the faith he has in me, he lets me know, I'm not going on this roller coaster. And the attendant goes, sir, there's an exit door right here. And as soon as she gets it, he's gone. And I realize, I just waited 4 rainy days and stood in line for 49 minutes, 27 seconds to take an exit door. And I walk out, having all the love and compassion in the world for a 5-year-old, as my family rides the roller coaster. You know what I learned? I learned the rest of the day, any ride we were going to get in line for, any ride that was going to take a half hour to an hour to wait for, before we got in line, I picked that little dude up and I showed him as much as I could about that ride. Here's what we're going to do. Here's what it's going to be like. Here's what you're going to see. Yes, there's animals, but they're made out of squares. They're not going to be that scary. Are you sure you want to get on the little leaf boat? I need an answer now before I get in line to get on the leaf boat. I'm not standing with you for an hour to walk through a door again. Do you want to ride or not? Yeah, Dad, I want to ride this one. Okay, let's get in line. And the rest of the day, as long as we were crystal clear up front, and he knew he had a commitment to make and got in line, we made it through Legoland with crowded season. I realized this week as we jump back into our study through the book of Luke, man, that is exactly where we go today. If you're just joining us, we're in Luke chapter 6. Easy to find. Back of the book is called the New Testament. You can flip and find the guys' names, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They're all big books. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Luke chapter 6. If you don't have a Bible, I encourage you to bring one. We're going to tell you every week where to turn to, where to find us, how to get into this. Look for yourself, not just what we have to say. If you don't have one today, you can share with the person next to you. They're in church. They can't say no. So just look over. Got to be nice in church. We come to that place in time today where Jesus is going to stop, look at the entire crowd that after 6 chapters is starting to gather on him, and say, guys, before you get in line for this ride, I'm going to tell you up front exactly what it's going to take, what it's going to cost, what it's going to look like. I don't want you to get 49 minutes, 27 seconds into this journey and realize this isn't what I thought it was going to be about. Jesus is going to pull some timeshare presentation. We have to sit through the entire thing and at the end go, oh man, I'm not buying this. Jesus isn't taking us on some journey where somewhere down the line you really learn the inner secrets, the mystery of Christianity. From the very beginning, to anyone that wants to hear about it, he says, let me tell you, this is what the entire program is going to be about. Way before you sign on the dotted line. Whether you've been a Christian for 80 years or 8 days, or someone just brought you here and you're checking out church or Christianity for the first time, you've come on a day where we are starting the teaching, that segment where Jesus stopped in front of thousands and said, let me tell you, before you take one step down this path, this is what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Way before you get into the journey and find out it was different than you thought. So you picked a good day to come and listen. We're in Luke chapter 6, verse 12. It says this. So one of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray, and he spent the night praying to God. Now when morning came, he called his disciples to him, and he chose 12 of them, whom he also designated apostles. Simon, whom he named Peter, his brother Andrew, James, John, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Simon, who was called the Zealot, Judas, son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. How's that for a title on your name 2,000 years later? Which one were you? I was the traitor. Oh, gotcha. Nice. He went down with them. He stood on a level place. A large crowd of his disciples was there, and a great number of people from all over Judea, from Jerusalem, from the coast of Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. Those troubled by evil spirits were cured, and people all tried to touch him because power was coming out from him and healing them all. It's a few sentences that seems like it's starting another great Jesus story. It's a few sentences that we just whisk by as a once upon a time. Here's the crowd. Here's the scene. Now, action's about to happen. But in those few sentences, I want to stop, pull out some stuff that you and I need to go back to and learn and go, all right, what's actually happening? What's he talking about here? I've kind of titled this, if you want to take out your note sheet, How to Be Wildly Wealthy. And some of you are like, I've been coming to North Coast for a long time. We usually don't talk about how to be wildly wealthy. Well, we should. And we're going to start. How to be wildly wealthy. Now, don't get up and leave yet. We're not changing our thinking on the Bible. It's exactly what we're getting into, though. To realize that, first of all, to invest with the right team. I mean, isn't that what you do? If you're investing in something, you want to be wildly wealthy, you got to first choose, okay, who really am I investing in? It's exactly what the first two terms are about. It says when Jesus spent all night praying, there were a ton of disciples. I want to break that word down very simply in your note sheet. Next to disciple, just write follower or learner. Follower or learner. It's not on the PowerPoint. Neither is the next one. Follower or learner. That's all disciple means. We use it in church as a spiritual term. Ooh, a disciple. A disciple is not a spiritual term. It doesn't denote a spiritual person. Disciple is just one who follows after somebody, one who learns from somebody. That's all a disciple is. You can be a good disciple, a bad disciple, a phony disciple. You can be a disciple of someone great, someone mediocre, someone that's a false person teaching truth, religion. A disciple is simply someone that says, I'm following and learning after this person. Now get this, because growing up with church in my life, I didn't realize this. Jesus didn't create disciples. They were all over in the first century. Anybody that taught a different system, lifestyle, belief, or philosophy had disciples. John the Baptist, we found out already, comes before Jesus. He has disciples, followers and learners of John. Today I want to challenge you. If you call yourself a disciple, if you call yourself a follower or learner of Jesus, then you got to really hear the program that he's selling. You got to really hear up front before you get in line. This is what I'm calling you to do. You can be a disciple of a ton of things. But if you're going to be a disciple of Christ, right from the beginning, he says, here's the program. Now, out of that crowd, he picks 12. He designates them apostles. Next to apostles, I want you to write this. Sent ones. That's all the word means. One who is sent. Sent ones. Next to that, you can write ambassador. That's all an apostle means. Someone who's picked and sent out on behalf of and the authority of someone else. You're an ambassador of someone. Out of this crowd of followers, Jesus picks 12. Why 12? You ever thought of that? I ask a lot of questions when I read. I just don't read and go, oh, that's the way it is. Almost everything, I'm like, why, what, who, when? Why 12? Why didn't he pick 13? Unlucky number? Why didn't he pick 10? Why 12? I don't have a good answer for it. The Bible never says specifically. I think the best guess, and it's just a guess I have, is when God picked a nation to send his son from, he picked Israel, called the chosen ones. And there's 12 tribes that represent Israel. Jesus is now setting up a new program saying, I'm going to tell you who's going to be chosen. This is going to be a new chosen people. It's for anyone. And the guys that are going to run this program, I'm picking 12. Maybe symbolically of, hey, now it's open to anyone to be chosen into this thing. Anyone who truly wants to follow. These are the 12 guys I pick. One by one, they're named. He picks them. I put in your note sheet there, Hebrews 13:1, under invest in the right team. You might want to circle that. Jesus is actually called an apostle of God. He's the ambassador on God's behalf. Okay, my first little timeout side note on this then. It won't take you long to watch Christian television, read Christian media, go through whatever type of Christian stuff is out there right now, before you're going to run across someone who calls himself apostle so-and-so, or I'm an apostle of God. I want you to be very careful. If this person is using the term apostle as far as back to the original 12, equal terms with Peter, James, John, as far as an apostle, someone who's specially designated, more spiritual than the rest of us because they're an apostle. In fact, I don't want you to be careful. I want you to run, okay? It's bogus. In the Bible, he picked 12. They're handpicked by Jesus. An apostle, the Bible is clear, you need to be an eyewitness of the resurrected Jesus, picked by him. Judas will betray Jesus. He'll hang himself and die for it. In Acts chapter 2, the early church will go and pick a new apostle to take his place. The only other guy that ever gets added on this list is Paul. Paul's on the road one day. He's going to kill and persecute Christians. Jesus shows up in a blinding light after he rose from the dead and says, Paul, why are you persecuting me? And Paul said, oh, that's good. I didn't see that one coming. And Jesus blinds him and says, you really want to see the truth? Spend some time in darkness. And Jesus calls him, follow and serve. And now we see so much of our New Testament written by Paul, called by Jesus on the road. He gets that designated apostle. Throughout Scripture, take this tangent a little more. In Romans chapter 12, in 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14, there's a list called spiritual gifts. Some of you have the gifts of teaching. Some of you have the gifts of administration. Some of you have the gift of hospitality. Some of you have the gifts of help. Some of you financially have been blessed simply to meet the needs of the church and others. They're all spiritual gifts. In that, it says there's a spiritual gift of apostle. Someone who does cross-cultural ministry. Someone who does ministry over ministries. Guys, that is not on the same level as the original 12. I just want as a church for us to be clear. We've always been clear on this. I am no more spiritual than the rest of you. I have a gift of teaching. That's it. Beyond that, there's really not much to Chris Brown. I have a gift of teaching. That's used up front. That doesn't make me any more spiritual or any less spiritual than the rest of you that follow God. It just means I get to use my gift up front. Be very careful of anyone that says, man, I'm apostle so-and-so, and because of that, spiritually, you have to respect my words or what I say they're from God. It's not biblical. You're not going to find it. Okay, that's my little tangent. Now let's get to the story. Lessons for wise investors. In your note sheet, some things already to pick up of this little section that we read. Some things I want you to jot down. I find it interesting. Jesus went and spent all night praying before he picked the 12. In your note sheet, if you want to write it down, I just put it this way. Pray now or pray later. Pray now or pray later. It's the choice you got. If you really call yourself a follower after Jesus, a learner of his life and teachings, he's going to model this over and over again. The very beginning of his ministry, we've already seen a couple chapters ago. Very early in the morning, long before dawn, he got up, he went to a quiet place, and there he prayed. His disciples come looking for him, saying, Master, the entire town is gathered. And he says, let's go to the nearby town and villages. Preach the word there also, for that's why I've come. He started his ministry in prayer. God, what do you want me to do? Where do you want me to go? Do I stay here or do I go somewhere else? When he picks the 12, he spends all night praying. After he feeds the 5,000, after a successful day, a wildly successful day, he goes up to the mountainside and he prays by himself. That's why the disciples get pushed offshore in that boat. His last night of freedom, when he knows Judas has sold him out and he doesn't want to die on the cross, he goes to the garden. He takes his disciples. He goes further by himself and he prays. Let me just challenge you as we're kicking off this next chapter of life. If you're a follower of Christ, you pattern your life after him, a follower and a learner. And if he has to take time to pray before major life decisions, what does it say about you and I? You can pray now or pray later. See, I usually pray about decisions after I've made them. And my prayers are usually like this. Oh, God, help me. Oh, God, how did I get into this mess? Oh, God, can you get me out of this? Oh, God, can you come through? Oh, God, big time, I need you. He's like, where was the prayer before? I was making the decisions on my own. And Jesus shows us this pattern of praying now or praying later. Now, every time I do this, there's a part of me that goes, Chris, you can't talk on prayer. You're a hypocrite. I'm like, I know. Well, you better say something. Okay, maybe I will. Why? Because there's other people out there listening going, spend all night praying? Don't think I'm going to go that route. Wake up early in the morning and start praying? Don't know if I can go that route. If you came to me and said, hey, Chris, as a church, we've cleared your schedule next week every afternoon. All appointments, all meetings are done. And we just want you to spend 4 hours every afternoon in prayer, just you and God. I would come up and go, thank you so much. I can't do that. I've never sat still for 10 minutes in my life, let alone 4 hours. I've tried it before. People of great prayer and prayer warriors have told me, especially being a pastor, man, you better be a man of prayer. And I'm like, I think I'm a man of teaching. I've never been a man of much prayer. In fact, every time I sit still and God, I'm going to give you an hour, I'm just going to pray about something, it lasts a good 30 or 40 seconds. And my mind is off on other stuff. And for a period in my life where I said, God, I want to get this prayer thing down in my arsenal, if you will. Man, it was frustrating. I felt like God showing up and going, Chris, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm just in solitude. I'm praying. He's like, buddy, how well's it going? Oh, I hate this. How do you feel about me right now? I don't like you much either. And then I felt like God saying, have you ever sat still your entire life and concentrated on one thing? Nope. No. Why are you doing this? People that pray told me to. He goes, Chris, that's not you. They're going to be here afterwards to pray for you. Don't expect them to get up and teach for you. You teach, they pray. Now with that, how do people like me and maybe some of you get prayer into our lives? If this is a pattern that Jesus is showing us, how does that work? I find the only way I can pray is when I'm doing something. I got to be kinetically involved in moving and doing something. My ADD, hyperactive, whatever they tried to paddle out of me when I was a kid, is still so much a part of me. I realize that is not evil. That is the way I am made. I feel like God says, Chris, get up and do something with me. That's why I like pulling weeds. It's like I like watering the palm trees. I do a lot of driving around campus when I get the messages or things or meetings or things that are bothering me. I walk around campus. I got to be in motion. To constantly just throw up little flares. God, here's my decision, or here's my lack of decision. I just ask for your guidance on it. Just to be men and women of God, if you're not great at stopping and ceasing and concentrating and praying, to involve that throughout your day, I think can be far more important than just an hour in the morning of your day. Now, for those of you that pray like that, God bless you. You pray for me, the ministry, pastors, everything here. Man, I believe our entire ministry rides on the prayer of its people. But I know for a lot of us, we take medication just to get us to sit still for 15 minutes. And an hour with God, that's going to be tough. If there's a decision you don't want to make, or I say going into this next year, anything that involves family, friends, your possessions, your position, spend time praying before you make the decision, not afterwards when things don't go well. If you already know the decision you're going to make, it's okay. Give God, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, the right to say, God, speak into this. Most of the time, the decisions, I just know I'm going to make this decision. And I just pray, God, here's the decision I'm leaning toward. If there's anything of that that's not of you or the wrong decision, I pray that you just close the door. Put a stop to it. Have you ever prayed for the contract not to go through? Have you ever prayed for the finances not to happen? Have you ever prayed for your life and something you're hoping for, relationship, finance, friends, whatever, to say, God, if this isn't of you, just keep it from happening? Why do we always thank God for open doors and not closed doors? You ever thought about that? Anytime a door is wide open, I'm like, woohoo, this is awesome. Anytime I'm planning on doing something and it falls through, I'm like, rah, 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 and I beat the smack out of that door. And when it finally doesn't open, I go the other way. When I should be just as thankful if I'm praying, God, that is as clear as an answer as the open door. Thanks for stopping it. Man, I would have changed it. You know what I prayed the most? The day I was going to propose to Amy. I prayed against that woman more than I've ever prayed in my entire life. Everything. I prayed for God to ruin every plan, the proposal, everything I'd set up for that night. Man, I prayed like crazy for that thing not to go through. You say, wow, it's really romantic. Hope she's not here today. You know why I did that? Because emotionally, with my feelings and passion, I was so involved with this woman. I knew it's the choice I was making. And if I'm moved by my emotions and my feelings, how in the world do I know it's of God? When usually we talk about God with our emotions and feelings, it's why relational decisions are so tough. We're already emotively involved. I prayed like crazy. I'm a youth pastor up with inner city kids in East LA, and that's what my life was going to be, and just ministry, and I knew that. God, if there's anything about this woman, if there's anything about this marriage, if there's anything about Amy that isn't good for your kingdom, for the job, for how I want to serve, then just cause this thing to fall through. Let her say no. I don't care how embarrassing it's going to be. God, keep this thing from happening. Change my heart. Change my mind. Change the plans that I have in motion. Change this thing from even happening right now. We're at a concert where we're supposed to be called up on stage, and I'm going to propose to her, kind of a surprise thing right there. I'm praying against the band. I'm praying for lightning. I'm praying for breakers to blow up. I'm praying for the sound system to go down. I'm praying for my name to be called over a loudspeaker, that I have to be taken out because one of my idiot high schoolers just did something. I mean, I'm praying for anything, any way for God to stop this. I'm giving him ways he can end this relationship. Because I already knew the decision I wanted to make, and I wanted him to know, God, if there's anything about this that isn't good for me, God, take this thing away. When you get to a why in the road, it's easy. God, just help me on this one. God, here's what we're looking at this next year. We don't know where we're going, what we're doing. God, I just want to involve you in the process. If you can't pray for 20, 30, 40 minutes, an hour on that, find times in your life where you're going, moving, where the radio's off, and you can actually pray. But if there's decisions you've already made and are going to put in motion, give God your emotional, your intellectual, and your spiritual opening to say, God, if this isn't of you, close that door. He spends all night praying. It blows me away. I grew up thinking Jesus just knew everything. He knew every decision to make, everything to do. He was God. And yet constantly we find him saying, no, he came to earth as a man to show us as humans how to live. Philippians 2 makes it clear. He set aside being God when he came to earth to show us how humans have to live this life in prayer and simply saying, God, you got to give me what I need for this decision. And when it came to setting up the 12 guys that his entire ministry was going to be based on, 3 years isn't very long to change the world. It's going to rest in the hands of these 12 guys. Man, did he soak that thing with prayer before it happened. Which causes me to wonder, if he prayed all night, why did he still pick Judas? You know? And then I thought, oh, why did he pick you? You know? Oh my God, after all my praying, you still pick Judas? And then it hit me. God, after my entire life of serving Chris, you still pick me? Man, but Judas betrayed him. How many times have I betrayed him? My bet is we betrayed him for a lot less than 30 pieces of silver. Maybe I'm okay with the fact that he still picks Judases, aren't you? Nah, just me. Number two, lessons for wise investors this. Past obedience guarantees future usefulness. Past obedience guarantees future usefulness. When I look at the guys he picked, we don't know much about them. I mean, honestly, when you look at the disciples, we really know hardly anything about 8 of them. Can someone really tell me anything about Bartholomew? He doesn't show up until you list their names. Someone really going to tell me about the life of Andrew, Philip, the other Simon? We really don't know much about these men. Church history tells us a little bit about where they went and where they taught and how they died. But the text, the Bible itself, really doesn't give us the stories of these apostles. As if the text from the very beginning says, it's not about them. As if it's telling us today, if you're going to be a follower, understand, it's not about you. The story's about the one you're following, not about you. Even verses we're going to come to in a couple chapters where Jesus sends the disciples out in groups of two to teach and preach. And the Bible says they went out teaching, preaching, and doing miracles. Then they came back. And I'm like, time out. You got to tell me that's all I get? Tell me the first time two disciples walked up and saw a blind guy and said, oh my gosh, what would Jesus do? You do it. No, you do it. You saw him first. No. We're just going to skip their stories. Why? Because it's not about them. There's something here in being a follower and realizing it's not about us. But there's something here also in realizing past obedience guarantees future usefulness. The guys he did call, what little we know, shows us all we need to know. He looks at a sea of people now that's got to be hundreds if not thousands from all over the Eastern Mediterranean Empire. And he picks, I want you, I want you, I want you, 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 you. I don't know why, but I'm still picking you. And I want you. Who's he pick? He picks guys that have already left their boats and nets and said, hey, we're going to start following. He said, that's going to come in handy down the road. He picks a guy like Matthew that left his tax collector booth that we saw a few weeks ago, a very wealthy lifestyle, and said, I'm all in. I'm going to follow you. He goes, that's going to come in handy a few chapters from now. He picks a guy like Andrew, Philip, guys that went back and already told their brothers, guys that when they met Jesus, like Philip, went and told Andrew, come see the Messiah. I found him. And Jesus goes, I can use a guy that's got that boldness. He picks people that have already been useful and says, now I'm going to call you to further obedience. We've said it before. We'll say it all the way through this series. We got to go back to these texts because the way Jesus dealt with people is the way Jesus deals with people. Nice, the front row led you. It's why we read these stories. You ever felt like you're waiting for God to use you or do something in your life? You ever felt like you're close, like you're on this edge and God's about to do something? Let me tell you, the best preparation to be used by God in the future is simply to do what you're doing now, but do it well. He looks for people that had past obedience and says, man, I can use that in the future. And this time of year, well, always my mind goes to sports, just like any good coach. Well, I come down to the last 2 minutes. I got a fourth down. I'm calling a play that I know that works. And you know why the play works? Because I know the players involved. If I have to throw the ball, I know who I'm throwing it to. The defense knows who I'm throwing it to. But I'm throwing it to a guy that can catch balls and doesn't drop them. 2 Chronicles 16:9 said, the eyes of God seek throughout the land. Let's personalize it. The eyes of God look at North Coast, searching for a heart that's simply devoted to Him. It's a God that says, can I trust you with what I've given you now? If I can trust you now, I'll call your number again and again and again. And He looked at guys that left fishing. He looked at guys that left the tax collector's booth. He looked at guys that went and told their friends already, come and see, come and hear. And He goes, those are people I can use. And the way Jesus dealt with people then is the way Jesus deals with people now. You want to be used by God. Be obedient with what you have. That's why if you're waiting for God to move and work in your life in some situation, but you have an area that you know has some blatant sin issues, keep waiting. Because you've got a coach that says, if I can't trust you in this area, why in the world am I going to bless you in this area? And I find it interesting when He picks the names of guys, He picks names that we've already seen. People that have already shown their obedience in little ways. Some in huge ways. He says, I'm going to use you again and again and again. I find it interesting, too. Side note number 2. It mentions the area, the region, the cities, the capital, and the surrounding areas, Tyre and Sidon, right on the coast in the Mediterranean that all the people came from. I find it interesting that these Jesus stories constantly, page after page after page, I've said it 3 times already, constantly talk about the hundreds and thousands. Here's the cities, here's the place, here's the regions that they have traveled from. Check it out. From Judea to Jerusalem to Galilee to even Tyre and Sidon. These are people that aren't just Jewish followers. Now it's spreading by chapter 6 all over. It's one of the most compelling facts about this book that drove me to this book. I so wanted to dismiss the Bible. You can't trust it. You can't believe it. What we have today is just a mere fraction of what was probably written. It was written by a church that wanted to prove what they were following. Come on. Has some good advice. Don't throw your life away for it. At the beginning of the series, we looked. If it was a book written by a couple monks in a cave, talking about what Jesus did in a little house here, in a little synagogue here, I could easily dismiss it as fable. But the book constantly says, no, this is wide open. We're going to list the hundreds, if not thousands, constantly. The cities, the places, and the towns they came from. And the books will come out in the lifetime of the people in that cities, places, and towns. When I said that last time, some of you wrote books or wrote your cards back saying, well, Chris, just because it comes from a bunch of people in that lifetime doesn't make it true. You're exactly right. Doesn't make it true. Literary criticism, though, finds it hard to explain. When you mention this many people in those many places, chapter after chapter, and we have nothing from the first century, from all these people, places, and towns to refute what happened, that's what's amazing. It's harder for me not to believe the Bible based on literary criticism, to believe the Bible. How come someone somewhere just wrote, hey, none of these things happened to any of these cities, places, towns? We don't have any of that. What we have, once again, is writers saying, examine it. People, time, place, city, region, empires. Check it out. It's truth. Just check it out. And now the teaching that flips it all upside down. He stops before you get online. He says, let me tell you, before 49 minutes and 27 seconds of your life goes by, let me tell you what you're signing up for. And with everyone there on the plane, he says these words. Blessed or happy are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you will be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you will laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you, when they insult you, when they reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. In fact, rejoice in that day. Leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven, for that is how their fathers treated the prophets. That's where you start. For five chapters, he's made it clear. I know the type of God you want. You want a God to come and bless your life and make everything okay. You want the type of God you can just believe in and then everything's going to be fine. And for five chapters, he has made it clear. The type of God you want is not the type of God you get. He went out of his way to say it. He went out of his way to say it as far as adding new wine to old wineskin or new patch on old garments. He went out of his way to say, I'm going to bust religion apart at the seams. If you're looking for religion that's going to sprinkle some little blessing dust on your life, I'm not selling it. And then he went out and proved it with his actions. I'm here to heal people on the Sabbath, even though it screws up the rich people and all those people in the synagogue and the very religious people. And then he went and said, okay, now I'm going to hang out with tax collectors, pimps, drug dealers, prostitutes. In fact, anybody that thinks they're broken, I'm going to be their doctor. And if you expect me to come to church and hang out with people that are really righteous, who don't think they're as sick as the rest of the world, I'm probably not going to be there because they don't need a doctor. And for five chapters, we've seen him say, the type of God you want is not the type of God he's going to be. He's here for people that are really broken and want a new life, not just a patch on their old one. And now his first teaching, he says, now the type of ride you're about to go on isn't the type of ride you're going to want. In fact, if you're really poor, consider that a happy day. Did you see the checklist he went through? If you're poor, read this for myself. Consider yourself happy. Well, I'm not poor. Blessed are you who are hungry. We're just going to skip that one. Blessed are you who weep or cry, because one day you'll laugh. I don't do a lot of crying. And in fact, any. Blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and they insult you. Actually, I've become quite popular now teaching. And when they reject your name as evil. There's only four of you. You write it on cards every week. I don't know why you're here. And I dismiss those. In fact, rejoice in that day. Leap for joy. Great is your reward. Well, I don't like these verses at all. I'm not a poor, sad, skinny fellow by any means. He goes, but that's the plan. And I'm like, ah. Is this the guy I'm really following then? Oh, wait, it gets better. Verse 24. But woe to you who are rich. You've already received your comfort. Woe to you who are well fed now, for you will go hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, because you will mourn and weep. Woe to you when all men speak well of you, for that is how their fathers treated the false prophets. Okay, woe to you who have plenty of stuff, well fed, a lot of laughter, and when people like you. Well, he just described my last week and a half. I'm going to hell. I'm definitely not a Christian. And what do you do with these verses? I've always struggled with what they're called the Beatitudes, the blessed verses. What do you do with these verses? The Bible never speaks against wealth or having things. The Bible never speaks about riches or being rich. The problem is we'll take a couple verses like this completely out of context. We'll push this huge poverty agenda on Christianity. Now get me, because last week those of you in the Vista campus heard me teach about what we do with our wealth, possessions, position, family, friends. We're going to catch that a little bit. But on the other side, you have to realize in context, God seemed to bless a lot of people with wealth, riches, good food. Happened quite a lot. In fact, the Old Testament, his entire people, he said, I'm going to take you out of slavery, poverty, where you're weeping and wailing, and I'm going to lead you to a land of milk and honey, fat cows and sweets. Well, how's that a blessing if now it's a curse, see? Well, that was Old Testament. New Testament, we're supposed to be poor and crying a lot. Really? The entire New Testament church is funded by wealth. Paul's missionary journeys are primarily funded by a lady named Lydia. She was a dealer, a merchant in purple linen, the most expensive fabric of that day and age. She would have been at the very top of the class outside of Roman officials when it came to wealth. Her goal was to fund the church. The early church met in rich people's homes. You go back and look at the ruins in the first century. I mean, your average house was anywhere between 700 and 900 square feet. Not a lot of room for a church. The early church met in the larger homes, the wealthy people that had more room to say, hey, we can get 40 or 50 people in here. In fact, for the first two centuries, that's what church consisted of. You want a chapter on wealth? Write down 1 Timothy 6. Do a reading of that chapter. The Bible never says money is the root of all evil. It says your love and desire for money is going to be the root of your evil. The Bible doesn't say you can't have wealth. 1 Timothy 6 says, don't put your hope and comfort in your wealth. And there I think we have this. Go back to verse 24. But woe to you who are rich, for you have already received your comfort. Constantly, the Bible says, where are you putting your heart and your emotions? What Jesus does with everyone gathered there on the flat area is he takes the world's measurement of wealth and success. Here's the haves, here's the have-nots. And in front of everyone, he said, before you question, think about, or decide to be a follower of me, here's what wealth is. Here's what you got to know about this ride. There's Christianity. Can you do it? Well, I don't like this ride before I even got on it. He goes, I know. You as humans are going to want this world and all this world has to offer. To make sacrifices for the lifestyle you have now is going to be contradictory to how you're wired. And he does one of the most countercultural statements in all the scriptures and says, let me tell you who's blessed. Not the people that have all the comfort and everything they want, but people that because of me are going to sacrifice and go without, and it's going to pinch you at times. Oh, they're going to have great reward. In fact, I love that. Rejoice in that day, verse 23. Leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven. I follow a Jesus that wants me to be wildly wealthy. I follow a Jesus that says, Chris, I don't want you to be wealthy for a short time. I want you to be incredibly rich forever. In fact, he will tell his followers in Matthew 5, I want you to store up treasures. Did you catch that? Not little bits. But Pirates of the Caribbean type rooms. I want you to store up treasures in heaven. The economy will never touch. Market will never take a dip. It's not going to be based on the house that you own. In fact, it'll never rust. Malls will never eat it away. Thieves can never break in and steal it. I want you, Chris, to be wildly wealthy forever. Don't blow it here. Store it up in treasures. It's Jesus' teaching that says, man, you consider anything that you have to lose. In fact, number three on Lessons for Wise Investors, it always costs something now to get something later. It always costs something now to get something later. Whatever business plan, whatever investment, whatever you're putting away for, whatever you're trying to build, you know it takes money up front, but you always calculate, but man, look what we can make off of that. And that's what Jesus is doing to his followers. It's not going to be the measurement system in this world, but he's telling you, this is going to cost something now. But I want you to be wildly wealthy. I want you to enjoy that forever, buddy. Forever. Somehow we've got into this Judeo-Western Christian ideology that heaven will be equality. Nowhere in the Bible does heaven is ever spoken of equality. Oh, do all the followers and believers get there? Yes, but not equal. Everywhere Jesus speaks of heaven, he says what you do here is simply your job application, your resume for what you're going to do for eternity. There is no equality on that one. And that's why it challenges you. Man, invest wisely in your eternity. I put it this way, fourthly, real discipleship affects our wealth, our comfort, our power, our fame. Isn't that what he's going after? Real discipleship affects our wealth, our comfort, our power, our fame. He says that following me means you have to give up something on this life. Man, consider that a happy day. If following me means there's things you have to go without, you consider that a happy day. If following me in the way you do your family, your relationships, your job, your issues, your contracts, if following me means there's going to be people that aren't going to like you or turn their back on you or doors are going to shut, you leap and you jump for joy. He says, following me is going to cost you something. Several weeks ago, I tried to encourage you. Is there any way you can think of that you can follow God without leaving something behind? It's not in the Bible. In fact, by definition, to follow someone, to learn from them, means you have to leave behind. And he's saying, what you're going to leave behind is what the world considers wealth. If we're going into this next year, and church, if we're going to get this, we got to come to understanding what he's talking about. This isn't just about poverty. In fact, when Matthew carries this teaching that he'll say in many places, he'll say, blessed are the poor in spirit. I think Jesus is blind when it comes to money. Rich or absolute poverty, one's not more spiritual than the other. He's saying, what are you doing with what you have? But wherever you are in the spectrum, following me is going to cost you something because you cannot go by the world system of measurement anymore. That's been flipped upside down. So when I get to passages like this and go, okay, what do we do with it? How do we take it? I always love looking in context with the rest of Scripture. I hate people that take three or four verses, make this an entire philosophy of what we're supposed to do. Christians, if you own more than one car, you're going to hell. If you have something in the ATM, you're not being godly. I hate people that take a couple of verses and say, here's what it means. Take it in context of all of Jesus' teaching, what was happening in the New Testament. And you know who I love going to? James. He's Jesus' half-brother. And I know from Catholic backgrounds like my family, it kind of messes with you. You forget that Mary and Joseph had a lot of kids after Jesus. After the virgin birth, they did the family thing. One of those brothers was James, Jesus' half-brother. Now imagine that growing up. How many times your parents, why can't you be more like your older brother? Your older brother never talked back. He got good grades. And you're like, Mom, he walked on water. So that's what you got to grow up under. James was one of those guys in the family, along with Mary. Twice they came thinking Jesus was crazy out of his mind for some of the stuff he was teaching. They didn't get it at first. His program was so countercultural, so bizarre. After they saw what happened on the cross and him rising again, his half-brother James, growing up with him, was the first to say, I get this. In fact, he becomes the leader of the church in Jerusalem, capital of Israel, if you will. One of the most important spiritual men in the area, James, half-brother of Jesus. He writes one of the first and earliest New Testament books. Turn several pages to the right to James. You're going to pass Corinthians, Romans, you're going to pass all the little Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians. You're going to pass anything with a T. Hebrews is a pretty big book. If you're flipping around, look for Hebrews. James is right after that, 4, verse 13. To help make sense out of this, what did it mean in context? Let's go to the guy that grew up with Jesus, probably knew him better than anybody, who understood the teachings and is teaching the church one of the earliest books. Here's how I want you to see your wealth. To give us some context, James 4, 12, or 13. So now listen. You who say, today or tomorrow, we're going to go to this city or that city, spend a year, carry on business, and make money. It's a good time to read this, isn't it? Now listen, you who say, for this next year, here's what we're going to do. Financially, here's how we're going to do it. Here's the decisions we make. Then in 14, he goes, why? You do not even know what's going to happen tomorrow, do you? What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it's the Lord's will, we're going to live and do this or that. But as it is, you boast, you brag, and all such boasting is evil. Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it sins. He goes, you know the problem, church? We're looking at this next year as far as what I'm going to do, how I'm going to work. We have this idea of success and wealth, and it's based on the here and now. He goes, why are you even making plans like that? Do you realize you're boasting and bragging? Do you realize before God, you're really making this about your life? Do you realize you have no idea what's going to happen tomorrow? He says, you know what you are? You're a mist. You're a vapor. You're here today, you're gone tomorrow. I was thinking of that. I want to show you your life. James says, let me show you your life. You're right here. You were born, you went through high school, college, you got a job, and then you retired. Oh, there you go. Man, that was your life. You smell kind of fruity. It's good for you. Did you miss it? I'll show it to you again because some of you are looking down. One more time. Here goes your 85 years. James says, there it is. You're born, you go through school, you get a job, little family, little married. Oh, man, you just kind of didn't make it, did you? No one does. He says, there's your life. There's the 90 years that are creating all the worry and toil and frustration. There's what you're working for. Somewhere up in here that faded away for this understanding of success. Where'd it go? When you serve a God that says your mere 60, 70, 80, 90 years here is a mist, it's a vapor. I want you to store up wealth that's going to be in your life 10,000 years from now, 100,000 years from now, 450,000 years from now. I want you to understand you have a soul. You are an eternal being. And don't sell out for this. And before you sign up, he says, it means it's going to cost you. Because there's things in this mist you're going to crave and you're going to have to leave behind. There's things in this mist that you want to make about you. You're boasting and bragging. In fact, three things to go home on is simply this. Identity sets lifestyle. Jesus says, look, if you call yourself a disciple, understand it's going to affect your lifestyle. What I mean is this. Plan with God's kingdom in mind, not ours. Plan with God's kingdom in mind, not ours. So, well, what do you mean by that? I plan for Chris's kingdom. I want to build Chris's kingdom. I might not have empires under me. I have three little ones. I have a house that's got a wall around it. That's my kingdom. Not a moat, but it's a wall. I build for my kingdom. I build for my position. I build for my title. I want to live for wealth, for luxury, for the praise of men. I want to live for everything. He stands there on the plane and says, don't find your comfort and your heart here. I want to live for everything that's about Chris. I want to build the kingdom of Chris. And I forget that word should have a T at the end of it. I'm just missing a little cross. How ironic. When he stands and says, you want to build a kingdom for Christ. And I'm like, nah, I don't like the last consonant. Chris's kingdom. He goes, buddy, everything inside of you is going to want to go that route. You're going to live to be on stage. You're going to live for the praise of men. You're going to live for wealth. Man, you make a lot more now than you ever made as a youth pastor in East L.A. It's going to suck you into it. What are you doing with it? I want you to take all that you have and say, God, what's your will? This is your family. These are your friends. This is your possessions. This is your position. In 2011, what is your will? I know what mine is. Kingdom of Chris. Kingdom of Chris. Kingdom of Chris. But God, if I just have it for this amount of time, what do you want me to do with this? That's going to count here. That's going to count here. And I serve a God that says, Chris, I want you to be wildly wealthy. Don't blow it on the mist. Oh, don't get wrapped up in your mist. Count it joy. Whatever you sacrifice in this cloud for me. Because great is your reward, buddy. Don't get caught in the mist. Second thing, it's about the same, but I put it this way. Then we need to make decisions based on eternity, not finances. We make decisions based on eternity, not my finances. Why does money drive me? Because I'm human. It's the desire for my own kingdom, not his. He says, follow me, buddy. It will cost. It'll cost some of your wealth. It'll cost your comfort. It may cost you power. It may cost you fame. And man, you rejoice on that day that you're investing in something that's never going to go away. I kind of put it this way in closing. For the disciple, for the real follower of Christ, this world is as close to hell as they will ever get. But for the non-believer, this world is as close to heaven as they will ever get. That's not politically correct. But it's a phrase Jesus will allude to over and over and over again. Church, if you're struggling in some area because you're obedient and being faithful, understand that is as close to hell as you will ever taste. I have eternity of riches in heaven. For those of you that aren't following Christ, you may call yourself a disciple, but it's not of his teaching and his life. Then he says, woe to you. Enjoy your comfort. Because this is as close to heaven as you will ever taste. And now he unleashes the velvet rope. And said, the program's open. Who wants to stand in line? But I didn't want you to hear this 49 minutes and 27 seconds into it. I want to tell you up front. For the next 2 weeks, we're going to go into this teaching that takes culture and turns it upside down. Love your enemies? Are you kidding me? He goes, part of the ride. Know it before you get on. Hope you join us. God, may we be a church of individuals that realize it's never been our family, our possessions, our position, our friends, or lack of. But God, this is your kingdom that we've been allowed to manage for such a short time in this mist. May you find us faithful so you can find us youthful. useful. May you find us people that say, God, what is your will for this? What do you want me to do with all that is yours? Because everything within me wants to use it on self. God, may we truly be obedient to your teaching, not our desires. In Jesus' name, amen.
So before we close, if you want more information about this teaching or any other teaching, just go online, www.northcoastchurch.com. Or you can come see us at 2405 North Santa Fe Avenue in Vista, California. Check the website for times of services. And now let's get back to some closing thoughts from Pastor Chris.
You know, on your way out, I just want to remind you, this is tough teaching. I wish following Jesus was, hey, I just believe in a God that's going to bless my life and my plans and my decision. In 6 chapters, he has made it abundantly clear. That is not the God you get. That is not the program he's selling. Right up front. To do this is hard work. It changes the way we think. It's why disciples never walk alone. It's why outside today, and this week, and next weekend, we're doing growth group signups. It's why over 80% of our adults are in a growth group. Because I need to sit with a group on Tuesday night in my living room, some people I call some of my closest friends, and just walk through, okay, how do we do this? How's your week going? What's happening? If you're not in a growth group, I challenge you to sign up today. It's the heart and the core of what we do here. People in God's Word, people in relationship. That's what North Coast is about. We'll pick it up from there next week. But on your way out, I just challenge you to turn around and greet another one of these, because you may not have that much time. We'll see you guys next week.